November Day, a welcoming winter. But I would like first to introduce a new member to the commission, Mary Lou Oleski. We're glad to have you from the New Haven Arts and Culture community.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Glad to have you. I wonder if in that perspective we could go around the room very quickly and just introduce ourselves so that Mary Lou has the opportunity. Linda, you want to start and go around this way?
Jen Widnes on behalf of Judy Greiman and the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges.
Pam Reed, President of the University of St. Joseph and also Chair of the Connecticut College of Council of Independent Colleges.
Hi, Judy Goldfarb. I'm an appointee of the governor and representing early childhood.
Mary Lou Oleski, I'm the Executive Director of the New Haven International Festival of Arts and Ideas and an appointee of Senator Martin Looney.
Ainsley Diamond, Policy and Research, the Board of Regents.
I'm Ted Junkless, Principal Academic Affairs Officer for the Board of Regents.
And also welcome to Ted as well as one of the new members as well.
Sally Reese, Provost Office, UConn.
David Walsh, Professor Emeritus of the Connecticut State University and former President of CSUAAUP.
And I'm Judy Resnick, hopefully most of you know, from CAA.
Co-chair of Education.
Hi, I'm Dennis Murphy. I'm Deputy Commissioner, Department of Labor, appointed by the Commissioner Sharon Palmer, who joins us in the room here.
John Shamo with the Metro Hartford Alliance.
Jason Jakubowski, Vice President of Hospital for Special Care.
Carrie Kelly with the Office of Policy Management.
Meg Green on behalf of Commissioner Catherine Smith from Department of Economic and Community Development.
John Bennett, Emeritus Faculty, University of Connecticut.
Lois Schneider, Management Consultant in the area of Science and Technology.
Margot Sajmichael, Fairfield University.
Ames McGinnis, I was here last time. I'm a colleague with Dennis. I was on Skype, but I'm hiding.
Dennis Jones, the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems.
It's a wonderful turnout. Jeannie, am I supposed to make this announcement about these? Okay, so I follow directions. These are announcements about public safety for the room, so please take a look at no location of access to exits in the hearing room in the two doors from which you came in. Are the emergency exits, and in an emergency, the door behind here, there, can also be used in the event of an emergency. Please walk quietly to the nearest exit. After exiting the room, go to your left and exit the building by the main entrance or follow the exit signs to any one of the other exits, and then please leave quickly and follow instructions. And in the event of a lockdown announcement, please remain in the hearing room and stay away from the exit doors until an all-clear announcement is heard. Officially dispensed with that duty. I wonder if I might ask for approval of the minutes from the October 8th meeting, please. Vagos? Is there a second? Judy? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is passed. And with that, I have the distinct pleasure of turning over the meeting to our consultants, Dennis Jones and Ames McGinnis from NCHEMS. For those of you that remember last time, we had quite a dense set of very powerful data. I would suggest you want to buckle in again today because there's more. It should provoke a very good discussion. So with that, let me turn it over to Dennis.
Okay, thank you. And as the chair said, this is part two of a set of data presentations that we've pulled together. We are not done. This will be ongoing largely through the entire project. As you know, we've heard from Vagos, there are some things we missed last time, and we're working on those. And the specific one in particular, two of them, one of them around degree production, but the other one where we've had data about race and ethnicity. He suggests adding gender to that, and we will do that. We're working on that. So we've heard from a member of the commission, and we are responding to some things we missed. This time, we are talking about workforce and the alignment of higher education to workforce and starting down the path of the fiscal context for higher education in the state and the alignment of financing to higher education, the productivity of higher education, and et cetera. So, as before, we'll put data up. Feel free to interrupt, ask questions as we go. This is not meant to be a monologue. So if you need explanation or want to question something, please do so at the time it's up, okay? Judy said, you know, hey, there's some data in here that's kind of depressing, but this is not one of them. This one basically says that Connecticut has the highest per capita income of any state in the U.S. So, you know, you are not Mississippi or West Virginia in the sense of being able to address certain issues because you're poverty-stricken as a state. And when you put it in this context, you're about 36% higher than the national average in per capita income. And you've been about there for two decades. You know, this is a state that has very high per capita income. On the other hand, it's a state that has great extremes in per capita income. If you do it census tract to census tract, there are some that are really poor and some that are really rich, and everything in between. And these are, you know, the very high income, no surprise, located largely in the south and southwest part of the state.
Dennis, have you done the comparison? Have you done the comparison of income to the cost of living? Because it's also an expensive state to live in.
Yeah, and one of the little problems is that cost of living data by state is nigh on to impossible to come by. But, I mean, yes, we do know that, and we can do it. We can get it, and we will by some cities. But having per capita income data by state is not something that's just running around out there. Cost of living, nobody really develops that and publishes it on a regular basis.
I mean, it's not the most critical thing, but when we say that there's plenty of money because of the per capita income, it may not be true.
Wages at all levels of education attainment are higher by quite a bit in Connecticut than the nation as a whole, and that is as true for students or individuals who haven't finished high school as it is for folks who have a graduate and professional degree. So wages generally are higher than the national average. And if you take a look, this is an interesting chart because it puts per capita income on the x-axis, proportion of adults with a college degree on the y-axis, and the color coding, the green, are the states that are in the top third in the country on the New Economy Index. And the New Economy Index is an indication of how technology-oriented the state is, both in its employment base, but also in its use of technology. So e-government, for example, is one of the factors in this index. And what it shows is that literally all of the states in the upper right-hand corner where there's high per capita income, high education attainment are also states that are, that one would argue, would describe as high technology states, that their economy is much more oriented toward technology. The lower left, which is the bottom tier, largely states where the economies are based on the extractive industries, agriculture, some of those kinds of natural resource-based economies. Louisiana gets a lot of oil money, but at the end of the day, personal income is low, education attainment is low. If you take a look at the New Economy Index and pull it apart, Connecticut is in the top 10 in all kinds of key factors. including migration of U.S. knowledge workers. By that they mean in-migration from other states, in-migration from other countries. The place where it's weakest, not that this is a bad thing, job churning, which is really defined as jobs going away and then industries rejuvenating. So that's not, that's typically the sign of a foment in the economy and not necessarily bad. It's viewed as good in this index. But, you know, you're high in venture capital. Just, you can see the list. So you have a lot of strengths on which to build. Having said that, between 2008 and 2012, you've gone up in the index in several areas, down in more than you've gone up. Overall, you've dropped five places, and you've dropped particularly in patents, IT professionals, scientists and engineers, in migration of knowledge workers. So it kind of suggests that there has been, at least in the last few years, a weakness in this economy on the technology side. Yes, sir. When we talk about in-migration of knowledge workers, we're talking about those coming from other countries. And all U.S. states are affected by the same immigration laws. So on this one, it says Connecticut was impacted much more heavily than most other states. And that's part of it, but part of it is also a lot of those, I think, probably work in defense-related industries in this state, and visas for foreigners in defense-oriented industries since 9/11 have been problematic. So, that's another issue. Okay? On the research side, clearly the life sciences are where you're the strongest. This is research funding all institutions, public and private, in the state. So you have Yale as well as UConn and et cetera in this calculation. But in some of the areas, particularly engineering and computer sciences, not nearly as strong competitively as you are in the life sciences. we start shifting to information about workforce and connection of higher education to the workforce, there's a point that needs to be made around this one, because every time we talk about higher education and employment, we make the case that the more education you get, the better job you get. The point on this one is the more education you get, the more likely you are to be employed at all. And particularly if you have less than a high school education, chances are 1 in 3 that you're not in the workforce at all. And at that point, if you're not in the workforce, you're probably taking from society in some form, whether you're a part of the social service system or you are in the correction system. But if you take a look at the evidence, if you have a graduate or professional degree, chances are about 3% that in any 1 year you'll access Medicaid funding for health care. If you have less than a high school education, the chances are 1 in 3. So 33% or thereabouts of individuals with less than a high school education tap Medicaid. And so, and since that is one of the big uses of state funds that competes with funding for higher education, it's important to recognize that more education is associated with less social costs in a whole variety of programs. It's not just Medicaid, but it's connected to corrections. It's connected to the likelihood of tapping other social services. There's a real investment in higher education pays off to the public, let me put it that way. Connecticut, much lower than many other states, has only 6% of its population that is either not working and not in school. West Virginia has twice that. But again, that number varies dramatically from one part of the state to another, and the picture looks very like the picture of income and education attainment and et cetera. So Hartford, New Haven in particular, areas where large numbers of young people who are neither in school nor in the workforce. Tony Carnevale and his colleagues at the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce project that by 2020, 70% of Connecticut's employment will require some form of post-secondary education. And by some form, this does not mean a baccalaureate degree. This means a certificate of value, associate degree or higher. So, but something, and we talk about certificate of value, we are saying a certificate recognized by employers, and that could well be Microsoft certification, and et cetera, as well as something that is a college degree. Okay? Yeah.
I wonder how much trust you can put in this projection. I mean, I can think of jobs where the post-secondary education may not necessarily be necessary or important. What makes you think that these numbers are trustworthy?
A couple of things, I guess. What Tony has done is what departments of labor around the country typically do and say, let's take a look at where the growth in industry is likely to be. So it starts with an industry then say, what's the occupational makeup of that industry? And then thirdly, what are the education attainment requirements associated with those occupations? And obviously, within any of those occupations, there's a range. Okay, I mean, it's there's some folks in management positions have an associate degree, some have a PhD. This is kind of pegged at the modal value of those kinds of occupations. And he's also taken a look at the increased education attainment requirements within those occupations. For example, not that many years ago, you could be an auto mechanic with experience and be a shade tree mechanic because you could look at it and figure it out. Anymore, you have to have some formal training to be an auto mechanic, just because of the complexity of what is there. The final thing that one will say, there's lots of anecdotes about college graduates being bartenders, and et cetera, et cetera. But the interesting piece of evidence is, and Beth heard this from Duane Matthews at the Lumina Foundation last week, that the bartenders with baccalaureate degrees make a lot more money than bartenders with a high school education. And part of that may be where they tend bar. They get hired into the tonier places, or they're just better at their job. But so even in things where you say maybe they don't need an education pays. Okay, and there's literally no evidence. I mean, if you put up the data during the last recession, individuals, the market for baccalaureate degrees kept going up. It was there was not a diminution nationally of employment for baccalaureate degree holders. High school dropped 5.5 or thereabouts million and has stayed down. So, is it rock solid? None of these, this is a projection, but it's projection by a labor economist that I trust about as much as any one of them in the business. Yes?
Along the same lines, you said he was looking, this group was looking at the type of, or in some sense, it seemed to me what you said was they were also looking at some of the types of post-secondary education that they got. That is to say, whether it was a PhD or whether it was a certificate of value. Do they ever seek to split that out and see whether there's differences there? Because that would be, if 70%, depending upon how it was split, that 70% that's required would have great implications for the type of education system we need.
Yeah, just a minute and we'll get there.
Okay.
One of the things that's been historically lacking in the census data and et cetera is data about certificates. We've got data about associate degrees, baccalaureate degrees, and et cetera. Everything in the census bureaus has been some college, no degree. So folks who went to college but got less than an associate degree. There is one survey that census did back in 2008. They haven't replicated it since. That got some handle on certificates. And I think that, again, in talking to Tony, he would say about half of these are probably certificates of value. So if you were to add 5% or thereabouts to your education attainment that is associate and above, you probably have a better feel for the level of education in Connecticut. And, you know, one of the things that's evident here is Connecticut is well below the national average in that number. The Census Bureau is pilot testing this year or next for the first time, specific as part of their data collection, ongoing data about certificates. Yeah. Yes, it is. And, you know, and this is one of those places where I wish the data were there. I mean, you know, because a lot of the certificates of value are, in fact, given by non-educational entities like the National Association of Manufacturers or American Society of Auto Engineers or those groups. And the data from those sources just do not exist. You know, if you put this, and if you count all the certificates against and the associate degrees and higher, Connecticut stands right now at 56% against the 70% that's projected. So there's still a hole, even if you count this, okay? Connecticut's job, you know, is employment slightly above, at the low end, you're below the national average. At the high end, you're above the national average. So much more of the employment in Connecticut already is at the baccalaureate and higher level. Less so at the associate certificate levels. If you take some college and associate degrees and put them together, it basically says that the need for additional education in Connecticut is slightly more at the, I would say, the community college level than it is at the university level. But interestingly, there's still a lot of jobs in the high school graduate only in projected for Connecticut. And this is from the Department of Labor in your state. And this is, Commissioner, this is your data. And what it says, when you look down the projected number of openings, there's an awful lot of them that are at the low end of the economic scale. And if you take a look at those that require post-secondary education, it's really healthcare, teachers, and you get down a little further and you can probably find, well, we'll go over here, you can find some folks in the IT world. Understand that these are projected openings, not growth. So one of the things that you find amongst teachers and nurses, they change jobs. So there's not that much growth in employment, is they quit one place and start another. And every time they do that, that is an opening. But again, you take a look, it's healthcare. Accountants and auditors and folks in the finance business, teachers, IT of some form, or analysts. Pretty consistent with national kinds of data. I guess I'm a little surprised on this that I don't see as many and the healthcare professionals in the room. I don't see as many allied health professions showing up on this list as I find in most other states that we work in. The folks like X-ray technicians or imaging specialists, et cetera, and so I will let you know if there are contrary evidence to these data, I'll be glad to hear it. But
Dennis, it's a little surprising with the low ranking in engineering, math, computer sciences that those fields are also not on this list.
And in a minute, I think.
Do we have a thought about what that means?
Oh, I think one of them is that those are jobs, unfortunately, that have been out migrating a lot of them lately. That they're going offshore. They're going someplace else. It's part of the shift of employment in this state.
Might it also be related to the high wages?
Yes.
So that the high wage jobs are not staying here.
Because it's not with the high wage comes also high cost of living, and you find the same situation in New Jersey, where the property taxes and et cetera are extraordinarily high, and they are going someplace else.
And a good percentage of childcare workers are now being required to have an associate's or bachelor's degree. So it's not just high school only anymore.
Yeah. This is part of the answer to the question over here about the various fields and what level. And so, what you really see here is that there's the low end is food and personal service, sales, office support, the various blue-collar production jobs. At the low end, at the high end, are managerial jobs of various kinds. STEM, not all that many of them, but they're at the high end. Healthcare, at the very high end. Okay? Is that responsive? When you take a look at the industry mix in this state, it's striking in the extent to which this is a financial services state. Banking, insurance, finance of various kinds, it's very, very high in this state. And therefore, it's also subject to ups and downs when markets crash and financial services get to be a problem. Interestingly, you're much lower than the national average on government employment, and not much. I'm sorry? the STEM degrees slightly below the U.S. average. Health degrees way below the national average as far as the proportion of degree winners. And this is in response to the question you raised about degree production by field. Okay. And we'll dig deeper into that. Okay? Yeah.
Part of that is that the programs aren't counted, and so the ancillary X-ray technicians and phlebotomists and other people that would be considered in that field aren't counted in this at all.
But that's not going to be much different in Connecticut than anyplace else. It's not, if they're not counted in Connecticut, they're not counted in New York or Massachusetts either. So I would think that it's, and let me, if you put STEM production against STEM employment, then Connecticut shows up very, very low, which is another way of saying you're getting all of those from in-migration of some sort. Okay, I mean, you can thank some other state for Maine, Vermont, for the graduates in this field, and it's the same in healthcare. That this is a state that is not producing heavily in either of those two areas, where in almost all cases you would say we really, those are fields that have high-paying jobs, that you would want production of those for your own sons and daughters, and it's not happening near to the extent of other states. Okay. One of the things that, you know, we can take a look at, and this is kind of a picture of what happened during the recession. And when you take a look at it, the nation overall lost 4 million jobs between 2007 and 2012. Connecticut lost 61,000. There were very few states that gained. And Texas is very fond of telling the world how great it is. Percentage-wise, you lost about 3.7% off your employment base over this period. Certainly not like Nevada's 12%. North Dakota, when it fell into the oil business, did fairly well, thank you. But if you take a look at science and innovation employment, and this really includes computer science, architecture and engineering, life and physical sciences, and post-secondary faculty in those same fields, okay? But these are all high-end jobs. Connecticut over this period lost 4,000 of those. And it's one of the few states that, in fact, lost employment in those fields. Percentage-wise, better than 4%. While the nation was up 4%. Computer science, I mean, and you know, take a look at these data. Computer science, and in fact, Connecticut was down across the board. It wasn't located in just one area. So computer science, engineering, life sciences, slightly up. That's consistent with the strength in research and et cetera in the life sciences as the one place where Connecticut seems to have more competitive strength. And up, in fact, 8% from not big numbers, but reasonably large percentages. And teachers were being hired in the last part of this, at least. Okay, anybody have... This is an area where, you know, we're going to keep working because it's... Everybody we've talked to says the connection of higher education to employment is a key issue to be addressed in all of this. And we're never satisfied with the quality of data. So this is an area where we may not have a lot of quantitative data, but we will ask a lot of questions of employers and others about what's not here that you need, etc. So we will keep plugging away at this one, and CBIA may have all the answers that they haven't shared with us yet, but I think that one can look at these data and say that there really are some production shortages in STEM, in healthcare, and we can probably go back to last time as well and say the production of things that I would call middle-skilled jobs, those that are associate technical, that connect to the technical high schools and provide the next step for them, that there's in advanced manufacturing and some of those kinds of fields, there are holes in not just production numbers, but the capacity in institutions to, in fact, produce those. It's an overall issue.
Dennis, just a quick question on the change in related post-secondary teachers' employment. Are we talking about faculty that we're churning out lots of faculty now?
No. This is employment, not production of.
So we're employing more of them. We're hiring more faculty.
In spite. Well, UConn is hiring, several hundred more faculty. They aren't there yet, but they started. And, that's one of their goals is, 500, okay, so... And a lot of those are going to be in some of these fields. This is
...1099ers, as an example, adjuncts. People, are they counted once or once for each college they're adjuncts?
They're probably just counted once because these data are individual driven. Okay? Let me shift gears here for
Dennis, just one question. It might not be for you, it might be for the other Dennis here. I wanted to ask about the architect in engineering, because here at the legislature we keep hearing, when we talk to Electric Boat and other companies, what a shortage there is of engineers. And how many openings there are, and this looks like it's going down. Is some of that related to the fact that they mix architects and engineers, so it looks worse than it is in terms of employment?
I'd have to learn more to answer that question. I mean, engineer is quite a broad notion itself, right? There's several large categories. Some of them there's a need for, others there may have been a diminution with the economy and with the federal expenditures at the sub-base, et cetera. So I don't know exactly how to answer that question.
Well, is it fair to say that we still have a shortage and so we should be concerned about investing? And
I think the answer to that is yes. I think the advanced manufacturing is one of Connecticut's strengths, obviously empirically and anecdotally with growth. So I think that really does need further investment, both in the Board of Regents side and in the University of Connecticut, which is happening.
Yeah, this isn't. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Quick follow up, Dennis. Do we have data on engineering jobs before the quota system was put in? And after the quota system, because we used to have large numbers from India and other places who came on a regular basis for both educational purposes and to stay here, and that there's been tremendous restrictions. Do we have any kind of data that shows the difference before and after these quotas have been put in? So I think that has to have an impact.
We have those data certainly in that sequence of time. We could give that.
Be interested to see that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You know, the other thing about engineering is that engineering and computer science both are fields in which there's rapid deterioration in skill level, you know, and you know, because the fields change so fast that you know, you either have to work real hard to keep up, or you move into management and you get filled in behind, you know, and it's very traditional that engineering jobs are filled with very recent high school or college grads because they are more current in whatever's going on. So there's, you know, and then engineers like me find their way into things that have nothing that looks like engineering. There's a more rapid depreciation, if you will, of skill in that area than there is in a whole lot of others. And that's another factor in job shortage or in production requirement for those fields. Correct? Okay. And as I said, we'll keep trying to ferret this out, and we'll, you know, I talked to the commissioner this morning about regional data on some of these things. And at the state level, regional data do not exist except anecdotally, and et cetera. But we will keep pushing on trying to get better anecdotes, if nothing else. And it could well be that if we ask the WIBs in each of the regions, that we'll get some data that we don't have centrally. At least we'll get ideas about what two or three things are in short of supply across different parts of the state. Okay, let's shift gears, and because when we start talking about higher education policy and et cetera, it always turns into money questions. So let's talk about this for a little bit. Beth saw this, so she can. She has a pass here for a minute. But when we talk about finance policy, we always think about it in terms of state funding of institutions. And I just want to draw your attention to the fact that, first of all, finance is, in fact, a means to an end, not an end unto itself. And so the whole question is additional graduates, additional outputs or outcomes from higher education, and what's the fiscal strategy that, in fact, gets that produced. It's not just about funding for higher education. And second of all, when we talk about funding for education, there's really only two sources. It's the state or the student. There are, you know, alumni that give money. There are philanthropic organizations. There's the federal government that provides money for research, etc. But in all of those cases, they are buying a service from the institution. They aren't paying for English 101, unless, you know, and most alumni, most philanthropic sources provide student financial aid, which is another way of getting to the tuition dollar, but it's not adding on top of that. So if you think about the fiscal policy for higher education, you have to think about funding for institutions, you have to think about tuition, and the thing that's always left out is funding for student financial aid. And one of the emerging issues because of state restrictions on funding for institutions, tuition going up, student financial aid is not keeping pace. I think it's safe to say that whatever we see in the federal student financial aid program is what we're going to see for us for a long time into the future. Pell is not going to get bigger. not with the issues of federal unbudget balancing or budget unbalancing at that level. Any savings will go into deficit relief, not into more program for Pelma. So, you know, and most states, the failure of public policy is to treat all of those things simultaneously. And the other piece to the puzzle is, you know, those are all dollar flows. The other piece of it is the productivity of institutions. How many degrees are produced with the money that is already in hand? Yes, and I don't have that as well developed, but it will. It's one of those things that will be here. Okay. Mm-hmm. And we, you know, we are also waiting for some data from both CCIC, from ConSQ, and et cetera, about student flows, where the students from which parts of the state go to college, by which type of institution, and just some of that as well, okay? When we put this in terms of how much money from both state appropriations and tuition is available per student, Connecticut is very high, consistent with its high cost of living. For public, this is public research institutions. Public baccalaureate and masters, not nearly as much money, but still comparatively high. Community colleges, not as much money, but still comparatively high. Forget Alaska, it doesn't count. It's just weird for all kinds of reasons, mostly structural. Connecticut, the students pick up slightly more than the national average as far as what share of it the students pick up in the public sector. And 20 years ago, the state was picking up 3/4, the student family picking up 1/4. Now it's very close to 50-50. And in a couple of more years, those lines will likely cross. And there are all kinds of implications for this particular fact. As students become the primary source and the most trustworthy source of funding for higher education, the incentives for institution behavior look, you know, I mean, the makes the publics look a lot more like privates as far as dependence on enrollments and therefore on competition for students and et cetera, because how one invests, that will become the major source of fiscal support for higher education, not the state. And as the state loses traction, the students become more important than institutions. You will see increasing behavior that says we're going to look out of state for students in all of our institutions because they come with full tuition, full out-of-state tuition, and et cetera. So you see the University of California moving rapidly toward taking out-of-state students at the risk of losing access for in-state students. Colorado, University of Colorado is already at 50% out of state. And there's a legislative cap on that. There's a legislative cap in North Carolina and Virginia. There, you know, that as tuition becomes more more important, you're going to see those kinds of behaviors increasingly. And, you know, if you think that Connecticut is unusual, this is Connecticut versus the U.S. Tracks almost perfectly. One of the little problems, however, associated with this is that loan debt is higher in Connecticut than in all but four other states. So, you know, you have higher revenues or higher amounts of money per student. You have a high proportion being supported by students, which is another way of saying students pick, you know, it's expensive from the student perspective, and that is one of the ways they're picking up the pieces. Yes, Representative.
Hi, Dennis. Does this incorporate just debt on students who went to school in Connecticut and live in Connecticut, or does this include students that went to school outside of state and came back with their debt, like Judy and I, who went to Colorado and got, you know, clean.
No, this is average loan debt of students who went to school in Connecticut.
Okay, thank you.
Does this include public and private institutions?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Dennis, I don't know if you're able to dig deeper into this, but, you know, like most states, we have real concerns about what's going on with some of the for-profits, and Connecticut has this big divide, so we have a lot of low-income students. So I guess one of my questions would be, for the loan, what's the degree attainment? You know what I'm saying? Is this high loan debt a function of students who were sort of churned through to get the dollars the first or second year?
We're trying to dig through that, too.
Yeah, I think that would be important for us to know, because at a regulatory level, we're trying to figure out how to get our hands around some of that aggressive marketing for students who are never meant to be successful.
Yep.
And that could be adding to that, because we have a lot of Pell-eligible residents. They're particularly targeted by this institution.
Yep.
So that would be great.
Gainful employment. All of that is an issue locally as well as nationally, is what I hear you saying.
These are graduates.
Oh, they're graduates. Oh. Thank you, Ken.
that's why she's a college president.
Yeah, that's why you get the big
bigger, you know, to your point, Beth, the bigger issue is debt without graduate.
Yeah.
That's what I'm looking for. You know, that's the question I have.
That's the real issue in so many cases is students who accumulate debt and gain nothing that would help them pay it back.
I'd say that's our biggest concern as a committee, one of them.
But again,
we've got a few things right now. But
but again, this is one of those things that's just devilishly hard to get decent data about.
And Dennis, along those same lines, do we know how much debt is incurred by students repeatedly taking non-credit courses?
We do not. Two-thirds of the students in Connecticut graduate with debt. And if you know, Connecticut is really for the public institutions, a high tuition, low aid state. There's not much aid that, you know, this, it says zero. It's not quite zero, but it's close. Of tuition, of student financial aid for public institutions. And the revenues per FTE student is higher than the national average. So I think it's safe to say high tuition, low aid as an emerging phenomenon. And it's not something you intended to do. It's something that happened over the last 20 years. Uh, Connecticut has very high tax capacity in comparison to the other states in the country. It taxes that capacity at right at the national average. So it is a high capacity average effort state, unlike New York, which is a high capacity, high tax state. New Jersey is in that category. Okay. The final charts in this presentation put a couple of pieces of data together. One of them is per student, in this case, funding, so state, local, and tuition funding, so state and tuition in your case, per FTE student on the horizontal axis. On the vertical axis, undergraduate credentials per 100 FTE students. And what it says is that there are, you know, where you really want to be is somewhere close to that line that I've drawn across the top of this. And Florida has very high, for the research universities, very high degree production relative to the size of the undergraduate population because of the huge numbers of transfers from the community college system. And in Florida, there are state policies in place that make it very, very worthwhile for a student to stay in a community college until they get an associate degree. If they get that far, they transfer into any four-year, public four-year institution. No questions asked with Gen Ed done. The four-year institutions cannot question whether Gen Ed was completed. That means that a lot of students stick in the community colleges for two full years before they transfer. Unlike California and some other states where they transfer at the end of 1 year, Washington has generally the same phenomenon. Washington has about two-thirds of all of its students start in a community college. And that means that a lot of them transfer to UW or Washington State. They graduate with baccalaureate degrees, having gone to those two institutions for 2 years. But Colorado doesn't have that phenomenon. They don't have a lot of money, but they also produce pretty well, given what money they have. And when I sit down with the legislators from Colorado, I just basically say, you can't expect the Colorado universities to move to the right, or move up, I mean, unless you can help them move to the right. That it's going to take more money to produce more in your institutions. Baccalaureate and master's institutions look very similar as far as this pattern. Community colleges are producing fewer graduates relative to the national average and to their enrollments. So one can take a look at that sector in particular and say, let's expect higher degree production. Turn this, the same vertical axis, different horizontal axis. This is dollars per credential produced, not per student. So this is per degree now. Connecticut, research universities, high productivity, but high cost relative to other states. California, Minnesota, Washington are states, high productivity, less cost per degree. Public baccalaureate and master's degrees in Connecticut fall into the same quadrant,
two-year institutions, lower productivity, still high cost per completion. Yes. And that's a function of high per FTE and relatively low production, and that gets you a high cost per degree. So, I've told you a lot over the last 2 months.
Just quickly, did I miss it, or where did those solid lines come from? The solid lines that were on some of those curves?
I mean, those are just the things that say, that's the economist term would be the efficient frontier.
Okay, but would somebody develop that? Or?
I mean, that's just me drawing that line across
okay.
the best performers.
Okay.
And leaving, you know, South Dakota has a particular type of two-year institution that is connected as much as anything with the public school system. They have historically gotten funded only on the basis of numbers of graduates, which means that they keep students in there and make sure they graduate because that's how they get funded. And so they get very high degree completion relative to their enrollments. And there are, some of these things are state policy around. Florida doesn't spend an awful lot of money on its two-year institutions. But it has high degree completion because of the policy that I talked about as far as transfers and the reasons why it makes sense. Okay?
Thank you.
The difference between price and cost.
Yep.
So the price is the tuition that students pay.
Yep.
The cost is what it costs the institution to deliver that credential?
Yes.
So when you're talking about the cost here, you're factoring...
This is the institutional view of that. This is tuition plus state appropriations.
From the revenue side.
From the revenue side.
But from the expense side of the institution, there are other things factored in as well.
And I don't have anything in here that reflects expenditure. This is all revenue.
Okay,
but it's revenues for similar types of institutions, which means they have similar types of missions. So, now it's time for a conversation, and I'm going to let Ames worry about this. But we need, if this is the start. Next month is the finish, at least tentatively, for, out of all the stuff that we've presented, what are the three or four or five things? We've got our own list, but we're not going to reveal them until we talk. What are the things that you think 10 years from now you would like to see change?
Yeah, and I think part of what we're suggest is if you even think of themes along the lines of what Dennis, you don't need to worry about the framing of a goal. We can get to that later. But if you had to say, looking at these data, what are the three or four things that really stand out that ought to be themes that are around which you shape goals? What I might do is put them down here and have you all give me your ideas. The other thing, yes, ma'am.
No, I was just going to get the ball moving. It's the first person out of the gate. Then everybody will start. What really hits me, particularly from our last presentation, the first one is, and a little bit this time is really closing the achievement gap to reduce income inequality in Connecticut.
Okay, debt, Yeah, income inequality.
Right. In other words, we have an achievement gap, but we also have an income gap, and we saw that in yours, and I think they're connected.
Okay, great. But it's also income gap, it's correlated with income. Yeah. Right.
I had a couple of thoughts, and some of this may be the naivete on my on how things work, but I'm always concerned about governance, and I know that that hasn't necessarily been reflected in these data, but that in order to make things work, the governance structure is really critical, and in Connecticut, we seem to have a mixed governance structure. And at some point, I'd like to have that conversation about how that fits into how we want to move forward as both public and private institutions, but especially among the public institutions. So that's...
Now, can I be nasty? I was curious of how the data that you've seen leads you to that observation.
Well, part of it is... there are different decisions being made at different institutions on how they graduate, how they use their money, how they transfer degrees, how they transfer credits, how they have policies that accept different populations and how they give the support to those different populations. Regardless of whether it's age, disabilities, et cetera, so some of that's that. I mean, my other strong bias is how we're really working with non-native English speakers, and is there a demand for bilingual students in the United States, or is there a way to provide supports to them so that they graduate without so much debt? Graduate in a more timely basis because they're taking a much longer time to graduate than other students. What are the supports that are needed? So some of these are policy decisions, and some of these are policy decisions at in individual institutions, and some of these are policy decisions across institutions because they fall under a similar governance structure.
One of the things that I want to say at this point that, you know, we want to talk about the ends to be achieved. So, you know, for example, closing an attainment gap is in fact an end. Governance, finance, and some of those things are means. We will get to those, okay? But we will get to those in the context of these are the ends we want to achieve. What means do we have to deal with in order to get there? And governance may well be one of those. I'll guarantee you there'll be a conversation about some form of finance, because there always is. There will be something about accountability and how one measures progress or lack thereof. But can we keep the ends and means conversation separate for another month or two?
Yeah, but I, among your points, was concerned about my.
Yeah, and that's an, that can be.
Really, I guess what you're really saying is who's really accountable for serving that. Okay, great. Yes, sir. You got it.
Obviously, there's a lot of ways to view all the information you presented. I kind of organized it in three buckets. Who are we teaching, what are we teaching, and how are we teaching? So I don't have any pithy notes here, but I think remediation, the efforts that have been taking place on remediation need to be continued and focused on. I think there needs to be a far greater focus on the performance of high schools. Obviously, that's backing it up to where the difficulty is when 66% of our students entering community college are not prepared for college. And I think we need to assure accessibility. That was part of your slides here today of all races and means and ages in Connecticut. What are we teaching? I think we need to require and I think we need to reward financially those institutions that have a better focus on connection with the workforce needs. that's not in Connecticut as robustly as it should be, and it needs to be rewarded. And I know that the Board of Regents is undergoing a whole program review looking at that aspect of it. Kind of a smaller aspect that does need support, I think, is we do need a robust information sharing system that's being worked on in a far more collaborative way between the State Department of Education, the Board of Regents, the University of Connecticut, and the Department of Labor. So we're able to measure success of these programs throughout the whole pipeline of workforce development here. And how are we teaching? I think the whole online aspect really needs some underlying strategy and support here. And I know that I think nationally there's really no clarity around that. There's a lot of experimentation. But I think that really speaks to the accessibility and cost issue as well. So I think that's something that hard to put goals around that because I don't know enough about that world, but I do know that I read a great deal about what's changing out there, and I don't see any clear pathway forward with the online experiment.
I just want to maybe focus this a little bit more. If you just take your who part, in some respects, we're going to be picky on this, I'm sorry. You're slipping into means to get to the goal. I mean, what are the real issues related to education attainment and quality of life in Connecticut that are not being addressed, that need to be addressed if this is to be a competitive state in the future?
Completion rates.
Okay.
Okay, so right. I mean, with completion rates, you need to look at remediation so they stay out
right.
the entire first
but
year.
But getting remediation is a means to an end. In other words, this
is the end you're
yeah, right. In other words,
correct.
Right. Connecticut could be the leader in the world in remediation, but it could actually be going backwards and other things.
Well, I understand.
Right. Okay.
I guess my point being, this commission has an incredibly large and robust
right.
statutory charge. It is almost replicates what the Board of Regents' responsibility is and the Board of Trustees of the University of Connecticut in running an institution. Okay. I just hope we don't lose track of the good work that's already been done on the
exactly.
mediation
right.
and lose sight of that because that needs to continue. I mean, quite honestly, okay. in my personal opinion, if we don't have a widespread community-supported preschool education, we'll be here 20 years from now talking about remediation.
Okay.
But that's not the charge of this group, but I think that's the truth that we really should admit to ourselves
Good.
As a state.
Good.
But in the end category, if I were to say more completions of underrepresented groups, in particular, that those are two really biggies that are justified by the data and et cetera.
Yes.
And if I pick the next piece, which you also legitimately picked on, and that is the connection to workforce needs as another major category, that, those three, I take from the conversation on the ends side, being kind of
I think that's essential.
I just want to, just to give you an illustration, another state in terms of goals. If you look at a goal of states of getting 60% of the population with some kind of a post-secondary education credential or whatever it may be, the only way you will get there is, in fact, by doing exactly the things you're describing. You must have better, more students who enter school, ready for school. So the preschool education is a major part of it. So and essentially the goals drive the whole system. But I think that's consistent with what you're saying. Now, let's see. I just want to be balanced. So we'll go first here and then second.
Thanks. I took a pretty literal approach to the quote-unquote homework assignment.
Literal. That's great.
Just listen. Thank you.
You're all going to be graded on this.
Well, I reviewed the packet that you gave us last time, quantitatively, and then looking at the data that we have here today. I mean, the things, very succinctly, the things that I would say in the first package of data that we had last month, clearly the gap in college attainment between whites and minorities. that was very stark, very clear in the data. There were several slides that discussed that. Second was the lack of first-time students attending Connecticut institutions. There were a number of slides that indicated
lack
that.
Of
first-time students attending Connecticut institutions. That was the terminology you guys used, first-time students, freshmen, out of high school, so to speak. And then the one I picked up on today, I think there's a real, you spend quite a bit of time here towards the end, referring to cost to families and individuals, both the immediate cost of education in Connecticut and then the long-term cost, i.e. debt. Those would be the things that I think, based on the data you guys have put together, that we'd like to correct.
And if I talk in the language of affordability of higher education to students and families, does that capture the last bit?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And again, it is a two-pronged effort. It is the immediate cost, and it is the long-term
cost of indebtedness and its impact. Yes, sir.
Well, I want to strongly second the statements from my colleague back there. I was also struck by some of the same information from your slides from last month, and that is the difference in college attainment between whites and minorities in the neighborhood of 30% percent gap in college attainment between whites and minorities, again around 34%. I mean, these are huge numbers. Now, I was aware somewhat of these numbers, seeing both sides of the spectrum, minorities and the white students and so on, but those numbers are really striking. And the question is, how do you close this gap? From what I see, a great deal of underrepresented minorities do not make it to college because of lack of information. I mean, information put in the hands of their families. Their preparedness for even applying for college admission. And in my one-page preliminary goals I send, basically, I indicate how this can be done. It will take some work from the Board of Education, I suppose, and other authorities to prepare the materials and place them in the hands of their families so they make their kids college ready. That certainly is missing at the moment. They miss deadlines. They don't know anything about tuition. They don't know about how to go about getting loans to finance their tuition and their expenses and so on. The other thing that's missing, and it's in line with that, is some kind of counseling by expert counselors how to negotiate the affordability of tuition, basically, and negotiate different loans, etc. This kind of service, statewide, across the board, doesn't quite exist. And I think that will also help in making kids college ready when the time comes. And this information has to be given to juniors and seniors, high school and even before that. It doesn't go to the hands of the students. It goes to the families who are preparing their sons and daughters to go to college.
If I just want to, just in terms of the theme of what we're up to here now, if you arrive at three or four major goals, another part of this whole exercise will be saying, okay, given the gap between whites and minorities, what are the specific strategies that Connecticut needs to pursue? And that's what we need to get to probably in February. So we really begin to shape. And one of the things that I think you'll find is that there are all sorts of things going on in Connecticut right now aimed at that objective. So we need to make sure that we don't invent things that people are already doing. But So your points are well taken, but I really want to push on what the major themes are. And again, I underscore the white and minority one. Do you have another at that level in your list?
Yes, I do. I've been discussing or mentioned it or summarized it as a tripartite college access and retraining alliance. And that would mean high school, colleges, and businesses. And that would be for the purpose of workforce retraining in areas of workforce shortages in Connecticut. So it's a tripartite alliance, high schools, businesses, colleges, basically. They got to come together and formalize some kind of commitment to this idea of training, retraining, educating, and so on.
Great. How about over in the panel?
I think it's a bit repetitive, but worth mentioning that we have to align our educational goals with the population demographics. Mm-hmm. And so addressing certainly the Hispanic community, and certainly addressing what is the obvious correlative of economic disparity and educational attainment as really a preeminent problem.
So part of that is sort of disaggregating what we really talk about, minority. You know, the needs of the African American population is going to be very different from the very sub parts of the Latino Hispanic population.
Absolutely. Well, not all different, but there are certainly big differences that we really need to address.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And you can.
Okay. Here we are. Based on the data we received last time, one of the glaring areas that we're sort of, it overlaps with what we're talking about with minority and white attainment, but it's those adults who've already left, and we need to get them back. I mean, that's a major population area nationally, but in Connecticut as well. A major gap is 24 to 44, 54, whatever, year olds who maybe tried a little college. And there was I think it was a Wall Street Journal article a while back that actually said people who have a little bit of college, and we brought this up earlier, and no degree are worse off because they have the debt and no credentials. So,
right.
So doing something to help those students or those individuals who've now been out of school a few years and need to find their way back into the pathway for employment and for a higher credential.
Yeah, if you look at that model that Dennis used last time, the evidence is that if Connecticut were to set a goal like 66%, Connecticut cannot get there without addressing the issue and without getting more of that 25 to 34-year-old back into the system.
So sort of a corollary to that would be somehow a better alignment or connection among the different levels of institutions. I think this was alluded to by the previous gentleman's conversation. So that how do we facilitate people moving not just from community colleges, but maybe from high schools to community colleges. And I'll refer to a study that was done about 4 or 5 years ago in the whole public school district in Chicago where they were able to find that so many low-income students under-enroll. So students who could get into University of Chicago were going to a lesser school. Students who could get into the state schools were going to community colleges, and students who could get into community colleges weren't going anywhere. So again, some way to raise the aspirations of students so that they feel, and their families. And a lot of the public discourse, I have to tell you that in our experience at St. Joe's, a lot of the public discourse around how expensive it is, people are only talking about the expense and not the return on investment. So that a lot of families who are less sophisticated, who they themselves, the parents, have not gone to college, are afraid about these loans. And you know, with my N of two, my two children who both went to school with the support of what I call the Reed Family Foundation. But, you know, the loans are not as scary to middle-class families who realize that they're going to
right.
make a path to a high-income job.
but for students whose parents are not themselves college educated and are not confident because they hear these stories about college educated people doing low wage jobs, they're not confident, and so they're afraid of these loans. And I think that we do a real disservice when we keep fostering these anecdotes and
that's an issue that so the underlying issue is greater sensitivity to what it's not just affordability generally, it's really understanding the populations you're trying to reach and how affordability affects them differentially.
And we'll get to this one too, but you know, being smart about structuring a student financial aid program, one that in fact recognizes the legitimate requirements for students to contribute something, but defining the something as not to the point where it jeopardizes either their academic success or their ability to repay a loan. On the one hand, that takes advantage, and particularly, and very few states do this, not only of Pell, but of tuition tax credits, and saying, how do I bundle that into the calculation? And something that puts some kind of, not without mandating it, but some expectation on, if tuition goes too high, the institutions have an obligation to pick up part of the need-based aid program too. That there are.
But as Dennis would say, that's getting into the solutions.
That's. But anyway,
that's. I wouldn't want to say that to him out in the public.
But affordability, generally, is on the table as a specific issue.
Well, but that has to do with also leveraging the state support versus the institutional support. I mean, most of the smaller private institutions these days are supporting their students up to 50, some even 60% of the tuition. And the state, even though they're state residents, may not be giving, they're not getting what they're getting if they went to a public school. So the question is, how does the state, and if you do your, I love your little calculator that you put in the last one, because if you show, if you move in that calculator, the marker for public, for private institution, if more people went to private schools, the state support goes way down because all the support's going, so it's as though they have lower tuition, but the state is putting in the part that.
If you were to, let me just put that around another way, is the issue you're raising that an underlying theme is what is the mode of investment that's going to lead to the greatest returns? Okay.
I want to be mindful too, just to let people know that we're getting, you know, 20 minutes on there. So I would like to encourage the people that have not yet added their voice to this, particularly, and I don't mean to be mean, the voting members of this group. We need to hear your voices as well today. This is a wonderful conversation.
If I were to, let me just call on one, and then what we might do is start down. Yeah, okay, we'll go here and then right over here, but then I'd like to make sure that everybody around the thing, at least one or two observations about you going. Yes?
I just wonder about the students that are leaving the state to go to college and concerned about the lack of conversation around competitiveness in a knowledge-based economy that is a global economy. And this comment connects to some of the things that Pam's saying in terms of creating opportunities that are more aspirational and not just limited to jobs-related education tracks, but in fact in advance our opportunities and society.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Yes, ma'am.
One of the things that I observed and the other things were the students that come here. Some kids leave and go out away to college, and they form their life somewhere else, and some come back. But there are a lot of students, really talented students, that are here, and when they get done with school, they leave. and that may be an area of enhancing our workforce by finding ways that we can keep these talented people or the college graduates at whatever level they are stay here. Mm-hmm. So that was one. And the second piece was something that we talked a lot about some of the older people. And I'm thinking about a bachelor's degree versus a degree in a career field or a certificate in a career field. So maybe to enhance people's work life or make them more eligible for jobs, that some work could be done in the area of what people are actually studying and tie that more to a workforce kind of environment, whether it's initial graduations or it's the retraining that happens as you get older. And that's a different context than when we think of, at least when I think of bachelor degrees.
Okay. Now, if nobody else, if we could start right over on this side and at least one quickly.
I just wanted to make one observation and then one possible suggestion. From what's been said today and at the last meeting, it seems to me that the public debate in Connecticut is increasingly dysfunctional and not helpful in terms of advancing the kinds of concerns we express today, especially from major newspapers in the state, business communities, and so forth. The positive elements of the economy that you showed today are rarely ever discussed. And although it's a means, I think people like ourselves have got to get out there and stress what are the real objective economic conditions in Connecticut, not the perceived conditions by some of the major newspapers or the business community who simply want to denigrate every spending program and everything that's been done.
Right.
The other point, simple point, as a possible end here, there's tremendous underutilization on all of the college campuses in certain times of year. And if we're really interested in increasing the number of graduates and offering more programs, offering full programs in the summer, in between sessions and so forth, would be one obvious way of providing more opportunity for people. Particularly if people respond to incentives like economists assume they do, if the tuitions could be lowered during those periods or there could be greater opportunities for individual study and so forth, you might find that that would be a good way of without a major cost, making more education available.
Good, thank you. Yes, ma'am.
So we've done very well at UConn with our completion rate, our graduation rate. We're about 83%. And I just got some data this week that shows that our culturally diverse students are at about 72%. So one of the things, which is very good, I mean, it's very good, so those are good numbers, but we've increased that pretty drastically in the last 5 to 6 years. But we don't know why. So we keep throwing so many different things, so many different programs. So what I would suggest is, you know, universities and colleges do some studies about what works. we need to share successful practices, not just, you know, practice. We need to kind of target. Like, we've done so many different things to keep African American, Latino males and females in college and help them graduate. But now, I was at a conference with Senator Bai, and you know, we really haven't targeted like which of the 12 things we've done that's worked the most to try to share strategies. So I think that's one thing that we could do that doesn't cost a lot of money and might make a difference. So
I just want to just to underscore something, and I apologize for being an irritant on this, but let me give you a sense of the kind of goal you said. If there's a major state investment in UConn, what are the three or four goals that was really achieved? Was it, I mean, that's the level we really need to be at. In other words, the investment in UConn was with the conception you needed to connect UConn with transforming the economy of
right.
Connecticut. That's the level of goal we need to get at. Mm-hmm. So, and we'll come back and talk about that. Then we can get into the means. Mm-hmm. So let me ask you that. What do you think the three things were that were really aimed at the investment in UConn? What were the goals that were really...
To increase our production of STEM graduates as quickly
right, it's really to respond...
It's right. You know, I mean,
I
wasn't going to mention things that I think had already been mentioned, so I
okay,
mean, I think
great.
Those are fairly obvious.
So part of it was to meet
right.
the gap in
Correct. Yeah.
So that shouldn't that still be one of the major goals here?
No doubt.
Group emphasizes.
Right. Yeah, I mean the increase in STEM, the increase in engineering, the increase in mathematics, the half of the faculty will be adding or in STEM.
Right.
But also other areas like digital media and digital production and. So yeah, those to me are already implied by what was said. But I do also believe that if we can help with a research lens of what makes the difference, keeping certain populations in school, that will make a difference.
Yeah, part of the reason why I'm stressing that is that this commission, in a sense, can provide a framework for both for all the sectors, for UConn's plans, for the. The university systems plan, but the independent sector. So as you all set your own plans, you can look back to this commission and say we're all working for the same broad agenda. That's kind of what I had in mind. Okay, great.
Hi, thank you, both Dennis and Ames, for the sobering information that you're putting out there that I think everyone at this table is aware of, but to see it in black and white is it's sobering and I think focuses us on our agendas and where we need to be going. I also wanted to thank you for speaking about the non-recreating of the programs that are happening, the initiatives that are taking place. I think that the sharing of information around this table is important because there is a lot of good work that is going on throughout the state. Unfortunately, Dennis Murphy stole most of my thunder. We had a lot of the same ideas, I know. But one thing that I do want to emphasize, even though it has been stated previously in this meeting, is the seamless coordination of our data systems between all the way from early education through work placement, and along with the data system, the coordination of these agencies to share our data, to be able to track programs, track student development. It's all I think that gets away from the programmatic level and gets more to the 30,000-foot view. But in order to get to that point, we need to be able to know that we have this information coming so that we can track what we are doing. It's great to put initiatives forward, but if we're not following them through this pipeline, we don't know what the product is at the end.
So that is, again, a means, but one of the goals then should be having a system that really is much more student-oriented, that flows, that really follows students through multiple providers so we can get a sense of how are they achieving completion through participation in multiple institutions.
All the way through the workforce.
Right. Okay. To employment and to the
Absolutely.
Workforce.
Absolutely.
Okay. That's great. Then who's next in the... And if you agree with the previous statements, actually you all have had a chance to make a speech. So why don't we, are we all set on this side? Why don't we switch over here and who hasn't spoken? If somebody has already mentioned something, please reinforce it because we're working for a consensus here what the issues are. Yes, sir.
I think you've already captured my priorities and they would probably fall under degree completion, but specifically, Dennis, last week you mentioned the importance of returning adults to college, so I very much support that, as well as better retention rates. So I think it's already been covered. Thanks.
Wait, when you say degree completion, just in general, getting people more through degrees or any of their priorities in any particular area? I mean, is it...
Just degree completion, generally speaking.
Okay.
I know we're going to dig deeper into that, I'm sure.
Right. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I want to reiterate some of the things that I've heard today. Affordability, completions, workforce needs, and the achievement gap. I think those are really the ones that come to mind most immediately. But with respect to affordability, I think one of the things that has to enter the conversation is that state support is not just limited to appropriations. It also includes fringe benefits, which are hundreds of millions of dollars, and debt service and capital, which are very big.
Great. And the other one, workforce? Which one?
Workforce needs.
Yeah, okay. Yes, ma'am.
I'll put my voice behind the idea of increasing minority graduation rates. We know that this is one of the fastest growing populations in the state. And as we have more retirees who are going to be relying on state benefits, we need to make sure that this fast growing minority population has the chance at higher incomes to help support our elderly population. And also, it just came up recently, but this idea of increasing the both, you know, interest is going too far back, but completion rates in STEM fields is going to be huge in the state in terms of aligning with the workforce. So that should be a goal.
Okay, great. Anybody, you actually get a chance for one more in a second. Well, yeah, no, I'm just fooling you. You seem to be so eager for this.
I am, first of all, in reference to earlier speakers that talked about new programs offered at different schools and so on, the question is not what new programs you offer, but how do you motivate students to participate in those programs? They have to be motivated to participate. As far as I know, only about 30% of eligible students, as a rule, participate in programs actually offered for them. And what to do with this problem, of course, it's a major question. The other thing is, I'm struck by the numbers you gave last week about the number of, holders of graduate and professional degrees that left the state, about 2,000 of them, and I'm wondering what is the reason for that. I know major industries, deeply manufacturers, have left the state, but there's a large number of startups and new companies and so on where these people could find employment, and I don't have the answer, but I'm wondering why this is happening.
Great. Okay. Dennis, do you want to...
I'm all set. Okay.
Anybody have any other... Now, I just, since we're getting to the end of this 9 minutes. I think just to emphasize where we're going in this process, we should really be coming in December with a much sharper list of goals and the metrics related to those goals. And I think that our next step, and Dennis will give me a swift kick, Chloe, in fact, that we might come back to you next time with our greater sort of refinement of these so that we don't depend totally upon this kind of random thing, that we narrow down a sense for what we've heard from you and what we feel the data says, so we get to a point at the end of this next meeting where at least there's a tentative list, because it will be that list that we really want to take to the set of regional forums, which Judy is working on. And so it will be at that stage what we'll really be doing is going throughout the state and saying, this is a snapshot of the data that that the commission has seen. They kind of come around to these four or five major themes. How do these resonate in your particular region? And what are the manifestation of those? And then another question, which several of you have gotten at, what are the major barriers to getting there? What's not happening? What needs to change in order for Connecticut to get that? And a lot of the issues that you've said, there are things that you're already working on, for example, remedial developmental education, but there are things that maybe the state is not working on, and it will be out of that information that you'll be able to really put together the kind of strategic plan that will have goals, metrics, and then a set of really strategies the state has to pursue. It may be related to student financial aid, it may be developmental education, anyway, whatever may we get into. So, Dennis, do you want to talk about the regional forum?
Jeannie actually has a handout that I prepared that is hopefully to guide the discussion, but clearly, the kind of discussion we've had here today, we need to broaden and gain more input. I mean, we would be remiss if we did not look at a larger community response. And so in talking with Dennis and Ames and Roberta and Beth and everything, we looked at what's the best way to go about doing that. And what we're proposing in December, if we can pull this off, is to create these regional meetings, two-hour meetings, that will happen the 3 days following our next commission meeting. a morning meeting and an afternoon meeting. The time will obviously change on a couple of different factors. These are not meant to be large, you know, come one, come all, testify meetings. These are supposed to be discussions. And so on the advice of Dennis and Ames, we've really feel that this should be a 20 to 25 type of size of a group. And this, by the way, will also be accompanied by a second set of regional meetings for the higher education institutions themselves. This first document that you have is about a community conversation that is not necessarily for, that is not for the for the institutions themselves. And I think you can all appreciate that sometimes that might inhibit conversation, and we want to make sure that we get the best from everybody. So as you can see on the list here, we're looking at particular types of people that we think should be there. One, obviously, are, you know, employers that are both from large and small and that are also coming from key industry sectors that are particularly important in those regions. And that we also include economic and workforce development professionals, civic and political leaders where appropriate, as well as trade associations and chambers of commerce. Our hope is that we will do this collaboratively. I've already begun working in the Hartford area with John Shimo, just as a, kind of a test case. We've gone forward and put together some potential hit lists that we're talking about. But as you can see, we split the state up into regions, and this was not an easy task, believe it or not. And so we're looking at both the Northwest area, Litchfield-Waterbury, the Hartford North Central area, Middletown, New Haven eastward, and then Fairfield County westward, beginning with Bridgeport and including Danbury, which was somewhat of an outlier. And then lastly, a southeast, northeast kind of a strip of the state. So you can see in each of these particular regions, I've bulleted out what we think are some of those key industry sectors and folks that need to be there. From a process point of view, we will be talking with a chamber or a regional organization in each one of those to work together to create this. So there is some regional credibility behind that as well. But obviously, if you have suggestions of people that would be useful, that's always very helpful. The second piece I want to emphasize is that commission members are, I almost want to say, your requirement is to attend one. I think it will be very helpful in the discussions we continue to have for you to have heard that. On the other hand, I want to respectfully ask that as you attend these meetings, you attend them as the eyes and ears for the commission as opposed to the conversant. I don't know how to say that nicely. We don't want this to turn into a commission meeting. We want this to really be the community's voice. But on the other hand, you know a great deal, and so your perspective in listening to this conversation will be very helpful. Given that, you don't have a way to tell me which one you want to attend because you don't have any dates yet and you don't know where they're going to be. This is a moving target, and it's actually a lot of work that doesn't show up yet, but my hope is within the next 2 weeks, I'd like by Thanksgiving or earlier, to have all of these set in stone. I mean, on the other hand, I will also tell you, we are not going to force it to happen if we're not ready. So our goal is really to utilize the talents of Ames and Dennis, who will stay for the, they will, by the way, facilitate these meetings, and they get to travel twice, two a day. Hopefully we won't exhaust them too much, and then get them out of there so they can go home to their families on Friday night. So that's the Reader's Digest version of what we're hoping to do. Again, the goal is to really enlarge the conversation, to really bring other perspectives into this. We don't want to go about creating a plan that is not representative. On the other hand, you know, we have to be very careful that this doesn't turn into solving world hunger. So with that, are there questions? I certainly want to make sure I give people a chance. Yes, John.
I have a comment. It seems to me that if you're going to get anything done within a two-hour period, that what needs to happen, I think, is two things. One is there needs to be some information available that everybody is expected, not is available for them to look at, but is expected to look at before the meeting, along with some sort of discussion of the agenda for that 2 hours. And the second thing I think is very important is that they be given a homework assignment to, in fact, get some feedback to our colleagues or to somebody so that they have a chance to not to think about it as well, and an encouragement to think about it so that they can give some even better thoughts than they might be able to express in the 2 or 3 minutes that they might get a chance to talk within the 2 hours.
That sounds like a really good idea, and it's just a question of feasibility. But I think you illustrate exactly, let me just underscore what the goal of this is, a couple of them. We will share data at every one of these sessions, and the suggestion we do that partly in advance. Partly in the idea is, in fact, to extend the conversation so everybody, the broadening the understanding of the underlying data. And we will also share your tentative goals and themes. So we're indirectly trying to educate a group of people. The second issue, which is always touchy, is that when you have a set of people who are lay people, many of which you are, they often share with us significant misinformation about what's going on. And one of the problems with having educators in the audience is they spend most of the time correcting them. And but it's important for you all to listen to the significant misinformation that is out there, because that is what creates the agenda for the legislators. You know, the legislators hear from what people understand. And so this is a chance for you all to hear in a relatively frank way what people maybe not understand about what's going on.
It's such a nice way about you. And John, you went to my school of meeting management. I never want to go to a meeting that I don't have an agenda and some background information. So I share that goal with you to get out as much as we can ahead of time.
Yeah.
And one of the other purposes is region by region, because we know we don't have regional job and employment need data. Okay, is to listen to folks in different regions and put some nuance to the stuff that we do have, okay? And so we can get a better sense of, from the major employers and from economic and workforce development folks in the regions, what don't we know from just looking at statewide or national data?
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair, we're all set.
I wanted to mention something to... that one of the things that you had mentioned include was schools, superintendents, employers.
The employer section, that's a really good point. We tend to want to include them on the employer side of this too. Yeah.
Okay.
The 10th. I'm going to rely on Dennis and Ames to help us flesh that agenda out again. I assume, you know, you're going to come back at us with round two of the sharpened goals themes. And
right. We'll take the feedback you've just given us, our reflection on them, and put together a draft that you then can shoot at.
Ames, you know, there's some people who are not here today, so they didn't get to bring in their homework assignment.
Right.
Are you accepting papers late?
No, we're into completion. If you didn't complete, complete. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's
okay,
a very good point.
So we should encourage people.
And run it to Jeannie, and she can get it to us rather than to, you know, that way. It could be shared to all members.
I think that should be true of any one of us who maybe something today we go home and look at the presentation, something else might pop out of it. So.
And again, I think that the ideas about means are really important. I don't think we want to, but if you could put them in a category that almost goes along, here's the goal and then thinking about the strategies to get there, I think, because that's what we'll be into in the next meetings and starting in the new year.
The next meeting is here, December 10th, in this room at 3 o'clock. Do we need a longer meeting? I think we're back to our 3 to 4:30. And I like the idea of putting everything, sharing with everybody, and in line with Dennis's comments about online learning, we should be practitioners of, online communication.
Okay.
With that, any last comments? If not, we'll see you next month. Thank you for your forthright discussion.